got to get you off of my mind.
That was Got to Get You Off My Mind by the late, great Solomon Burke, one of the best soul singers of all time, born on this day in 1940. We're about to have another conversation with Jossie Ross, member of the Blackfoot Nation. He's a father, writer, entrepreneur, attorney, went to Columbia Law School, practices law now, representing in the Crowell Law Office's Travel Advocacy Group. And his latest book is How to Say I Love You in Indian. Jossie, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Mark. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, my friend.
I love this book. Didn't know what to expect, as many people didn't when they opened the book, because it's not some silly Valentine's book, but a look at what's underneath the real definition of the power of love that keeps people and life together.
Yeah. I mean, love is about survival, right? And love is about, I recognize this more as I grow in fatherhood. And, you know, I always thought I understood fatherhood when I was an uncle. I've been an uncle since I was 12 years old. And I have a very close relationship with all my nieces and nephews. But I understand that when people say, if you don't love yourself, you can't love anybody else. And that's so true, because it's the most basic human instinct, that is to love yourself, to survive. And the way oftentimes we, you know, kind of categorize survival or you know, filter survival is by reproduction, physical reproduction, and the survival of those who we say we care about. Like, so my son. My son is going to carry on my name, my legacy, whatever that might be. It might be a bad thing. But he's going to carry on. He's going to carry on. You know, he promises immortality for me, because through him I live. So survival of the species, survival of native people is what this book is all about. How do we survive in these ridiculously absurd conditions that we found ourselves in historically, and there were specific techniques that ensured our survival? And that's kind of just some of the discussions. It's not necessarily it's not a historical book, but it's just talking about how we love native people. We love desperately, because we come from desperate conditions in recent history.
In the beginning of the book, you really leap into that, and to set the context, when you say that the whole idea of native love survive in the face of it all, that you wrote, it's a fallacy, an evil white supremacist myth that wants to demonize all men of color while ignoring the same behaviors in white men, when you talk about how Indian men are looked at. I mean, so you attack this from the beginning as a way of showing kind of the power that is unseen, that if Indian people didn't have it, you'd be gone.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, that's one of the, I mean, it's not just native people. I mean, we've recently had a discussion about white supremacy in the context of Trayvon Martin or Jordan Davis. And there's this underlying suspicion that men of color are always doing something wrong. And that includes necessarily our tactics with fatherhood. You know, we show these empirical statistics, this data that says, well, men of color, there's this amount of men of color, specifically native babies, who are being raised fatherless. And that's true. Like, that's an absolutely true statement, that there are a lot of children of color who are being raised in fatherless homes. But the punchline, and this is the part that this is the demonization process, this is the white supremacy process, is that in the United States, irrespective of color, there's a huge, huge growing amount of kids who are being raised in fatherless homes. It's not just men of color, it's not just native homes, it's not just black homes, but the emphasis on us is that we can't do anything right, so let's pay attention to those negative statistics. And I'm definitely all for calling out and holding fathers accountable. I consider myself a very accountable father, but at the same time, don't hold us to a different standard than you hold anybody else to. And that, there are those examples, and I think, you know, I try to make the case in there that there are those examples within our communities of people who are doing, there's amazing programs that are going on to teach us, you know, fatherhood skills, many of us who were raised without fathers, like myself, and programs are working.
So in the book, you have a lot of stories. You have this incredible poem, Opium. If we had time, I'd love you to have to read a piece of that. But I want to start with Arlen. And I bet you everybody loves this story. The fifth grade James Bond. It's real. It's you. It's your friend. It's a story that is multi-layered, from mother love to uncle love.
Yeah.
It's a long story, but it's an incredible story.
All the stories. I suppose anything you write, anything you say has a level of autobiographical nature to it.
Right.
This definitely does. I mean, that wasn't me. You know, it wasn't me. You know, I, the stories are composite. You know, my mom certainly struggled. God bless her. She's still around today. She made it through her struggles, and she's doing very well now. But, you know, like many in impoverished communities, she struggled with alcohol, and she was a single mom, and she was trying to, you know, make ends meet in a community that is very, very, very impoverished. That is 70% unemployment, so it's hard to find a job. So maintain the financial well-being of a family, single mom, and at the same time, keep your sanity. And those two things are oftentimes difficult to juggle. And so it's a composite. It's a composite of many stories that I saw throughout my life. A lot of my friends, there was this kid, and I won't say any names because it's a small community that I grew up in.
Right.
You know, there really was a couple of kids that they drove themselves to school. And I remember, you know, I didn't really think too much of it until my older sister, she started driving us around, and she kind of became the authority figure. And I always refer to her, tomorrow's her birthday, and I always refer to her as my second mom, because she started raising me, you know, as a young girl. And so, you know, I understood then, you know, we never had any conversations about it, me and these other kids who drove themselves to school, because that, like I said, that wasn't me. But when I saw my sister driving us around and the reasons why she had to drive us around, I started to understand, oh, okay, it's not quite as cool as it looks. There's a reason why, functionally, she has to do that, or these other kids have to do that.
You know, it's funny, because when I read the story, I actually thought you were telling the story about your friend Arlen, but it was a composite. But the story, I think the love of his mom, how she broke down and cried because she, even though she was drinking too much, she was doing everything she could to protect him and protect her children. And that's a layered piece of importance, because we demonize people who fall into this world of addiction and really struggle to get out and love their families. And we have this system that just kind of completely separates people from that. And from their families, you know what I'm saying?
I do, and you know, the unfortunate thing, Mark, is that, you know, and I can't say it's an American thing. I've never lived anyplace else. I've been to other countries, but I never lived anyplace else. But one of the things that I think that is unique in Native culture, and I don't necessarily see it represented well other places, is we're able to, and maybe it's a, you know, it's a result of history and having so much negative history in recent times, where we had to compartmentalize different parts of us. You know, we had to compartmentalize and not judge as much as I see in mainstream culture. When somebody does something wrong in mainstream culture, they're forever known as that person. You know, and I think that might be a byproduct of Christianity / organized religion. But within our culture, within Native culture, it really is a come as you are culture and religion. So, you know, within Blackfeet traditions, you have people, you don't have to get right before you go to church. The process of getting right is going to ceremony. And so one of the things that I think that I'm able to do pretty effectively is right without judgment, because I live pretty much without judgment. Okay, you know, yeah, mom struggled with alcohol, my dad struggled with drugs, and that's just the life that it was, and it wasn't necessarily indicative of their character. It didn't necessarily mean that they're forever stained by that. My mom is no longer an alcoholic. She's doing very well. She's a wonderful woman. You know, but at one time, she certainly struggled, and she used that as a learning mechanism and a conduit to do better. And you know, I think that's something that's very, and very Indian trait.
And I think you feel that throughout this book. And Jossie, one of the things I wanted to talk about also in this, to finish up this conversation about Arlen, which I think was just such a powerful story, I just loved it, is the relationship between Arlen, this young kid who drives his mother back and forth to the War Bonnet, the bar on the res, and her, and he's taking care of the kids, and the old drunk he meets, Wishy. You know, people can read that story of Wishy and Arlen, and I'll let you tell a little bit of it and talk about what it means. And they can look at it and go, no, this couldn't happen. Unless you came from a certain place and you knew it could happen.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It happens all the time.
Yes, right.
And, you know, and that's another, you know, Wishy. And, I mean, and this is a story that, you know, the Wishy component, Wishy for the listeners, first of all, thank you guys very much for listening. And, yeah, definitely go check out the book. It's called How to Say I Love You in Indian, because there's some beautiful stories in there. And I think this is probably the best, this story is the best story I've ever written. Wishy is a somebody at home, you know, on the res that we would call a wino, very politically incorrectly. But here's the thing about winos within our communities, that unlike, this is another thing about judgment and the difference, just the contrast, I'm not saying one's right and what's wrong. You know, within our communities, Native communities, we don't necessarily have expendable people. Winos have value. Homeless people have values just like anybody else. And this story tried to illustrate a little bit about how we do not have expendables. Wishy, although he was homeless and he was stink and he was a drunk and this, that, and a third, all these things that make within American culture people undesirable, and therefore different mayors and municipality leaders, they try to get rid of these undesirable people in different ways, whether it be with tent camps and stuff like that. For us, they're a fabric of our society. And we try to, you know, take the value out of them and say, look, if you have something to teach, something to contribute, then you can contribute it. And this was, you know, the story, and I don't want to give away too much of the story, but this is the story of a guy who would be considered undesirable in many communities, showing that he still had value and can contribute to larger society. And he contributed in a very big way to Arlen's life and his family's life.
I think it's a great story. I could see this whole story of Arlen as like a short 20-minute film.
Yeah, we're actually working on that.
Now, I'm going to let you think you stole that idea from me.
Yeah. I will credit you, Mark.
So
we're actually going to make it longer than 20 minutes, you know, because I think that the characters and the understory, you know, the backstory on it are really rich. You know, that is that, you know, because there's different layers of love, because once again, that's what the book is about. It's about love. And so the love that this man has for this child is an extremely, extremely, well, we're demonizing. And once again, I can testify, and I do testify, to the power of Native men who had absolutely no incentive other than just being loving creatures to love somebody who, you know, wasn't a member of their family like was in this situation. And I had men, I have mentors, Native mentors, and I have non-Native mentors as well, but I have Native mentors. The same mentors who get, you know, who get demonized as not taking care of their kids, people who took care of me and who still take care of me and who nourished me and literally made sure that I was okay when I was growing up. And they didn't have any incentive to. So Wishy is one of those characters that I grew up and had the God-blessed fortune to be able to say, these guys who, you know, would have no value in many other societies, they, you know, they definitely stepped up to the plate. And they definitely made sure that at least one young Native man was going in the right direction. And they understood, you know, back to the non-judgment thing, they understood the power of their love, and they understood that they had the power to make an impact. And, you know, and so they expressed that love through very, very rigid and strong lines in the sand. They said, you're not going to do this, you're not going to do this. And in effect, they became proxy parents, proxy fathers for me.
You talk about Grandpa Percy and Peter and other people that Peter Joe that you learned from as a young man. And there's another story, there's a piece in here I think that is emblematic of what happens more and more in the Native world. Is it Sutro, the story you have about the young woman who grew up non-Native, but who was Native in Nashville.
Yeah.
And that's not an uncommon story, because all the adoptions going off of reservations and people taking babies they shouldn't take and sometimes they should take or whatever. But you know what I'm saying? I mean, it's not an uncommon story. The Chris Iyer, the filmmaker, that's his story, right?
Right. No, it happens a lot, and you know, and also it happens for you know, definitely those sort of stories of adoption and forced adoption and et cetera, and incentivized adoption. This is one of the things, you know, that people don't. It hasn't really gotten the press, and maybe it shouldn't. I don't know. I'm not today, but you know, incentivized adoptions where people say, "Well, we're going to you're poor Indian person, and we're going to take your Indian baby out and raise them here, and you know, you can never contact them, and they can never have contact with you. But in exchange for that silence, your child is going to be raised in a very, very financially stable and gratifying, you know, place." And I mean, I'm not to say whether that's right, wrong, or right. I mean, you know, if the parent thinks that it's in the child's best interest, maybe. But those adoptions happen as well, and they don't necessarily get as much attention because they're not illegal. And, you know, and that's fine. It's not a matter of legality. But, in Sutro, you know, Sutro was more about, in my estimation, it was more about loving yourself. And that's something that I think that Native people, I think that people of color were taught. And this sounds really, really conspiratorial, and I'll live with that. That's fine. But we're taught not to love ourselves. And we're taught not to love the image of ourselves. And, you know, you can go back historically, the whole European concept of beauty, you know, the white Jesus, the white angels, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm talking even more contemporary, you know, that there's a definite movement within mass media to prop up images. And that's the reason why, for example, at the Oscars the other night, it was such a big deal for Lupita. Is that my pronouncer?
Yes, that's correct.
Actress.
Lupita, right.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, that was such a big deal. And I don't necessarily, you know, I mean, people were, to me, on Twitter and stuff, they were making such a big deal about it, you know, like, oh, you know, she's so gorgeous and stuff like that. And I'm like, yeah, she's cool. She's cute. But the reason why they're having that response isn't necessarily because, you know, beauty's an eye of the beholder. They can feel however they want. But it's just because they've never seen somebody that with that such dark skin, female, a female person, who had that sense of self-love and talked about loving their own skin. And so that's what it was about. It's not necessarily about whether or not subjectively she has that level of beauty. It's that she's accepting of herself, because that's something that we have a really hard time doing and we've been trained not to. And so this story, Sutro, was a very contemporary, very, very Indian way of explaining that within the Native context, you know, that this young lady had a hard time you know, in this culture of social media where every movement has to be photographed and documented. She has a, you know, overcompensatory thing where she, you know, is trying to find self-love. And, you know, that's what the story ultimately was about to me.
Well, and also at the end, and you kind of, I love the way you kind of put some things at the end here. It was a very kind of, it was a very moving ending to the story, which we won't talk about. It was very powerful what she tried to do, trying to find a way to get back to who she was, to what her roots were.
Yeah, and when we talk about getting back to her roots, absolutely, Mark, that's exactly what it's about, is getting back to her roots. But that's not necessarily a geographical area. That's an existential state and a spiritual state that comes from tens of thousands of years of self-love. And you, within, we all come from hunter-gatherer cultures. We all come from small communities at some point. I'm talking around the world, not just Native people within this country, but we all come from these small communities and, you know, have indigenous roots at some place. And those small communities required you to have a certain amount of self-love. It's more of an existential state that I think she was finding herself in, where she was getting more comfortable with, yeah, this is who I am. And I have a function. I have a role in this world. And that role is part of this family, and that role is part of this community. And I think that that's something that is missing within a lot of our communities. And I'm not just talking about Native people. I'm talking about the massive consumerism that all of America finds itself in.
What I'd like to do, just to get a sense of this, because you're such, I think, a really good writer. I mean, your conversation with people is compelling, but I think your words are really compelling as well when you put them on paper. Is there a piece of this you want to read, one of the poems, a piece of the book, maybe a couple of pieces of the book? What would you pick?
I'm always down to read. Well, I'd like to read a little bit of the intro, if you don't mind.
No, do that. Let's start there. That sounds good. Let's start there.
Okay. Love is not a soft or sentimental thing. Love sets rules. Love defends and draws lines in sand. Love creates expectations. Love says, my love doesn't have conditions, but it does have expectations. Oftentimes people confuse the two, that having unconditional is that you fall for anything. No, that is not love. Love is putting up strict and strong rules for your children. You will not play close to the street. I don't care how bad you want to. Love is the motivation. We want our children to survive and thrive. Love motivates us to take a hard line. I will not allow alcohol in this house. We are not going to repeat history. That hard line helps our children to do better. That particular passage right there is, like a lot of stuff that I write, it's a reminder to myself as a father that we talk about unconditional love, and our community expresses the most powerful examples of unconditional love, once again, without judgment, that I've ever seen any place. And granted, I've never lived in another country, but I've been to other countries, and I've never seen this level of unconditional love. But there's also the component where, yeah, it's unconditional, but we still expect stuff of you. You still have to perform as a human being within this culture, within this society, and within this community. And I think that that's something that Native people, quite honestly, you know, that's a critique. We need to get better on the expectation side, because we're really, really good on the unconditional side, but at the same time, we need our people to come through. What's the flip side of love? Responsibility, you know, and we need that responsibility component. There's a piece that you referenced, Mark, and it's called Opium.
Yeah, the poem.
And if I could set that up a little bit, it's just a short little poem, and the poem is about opium, the perfume, and it was about my grandmother. My grandmother passed in 2012, and I'm a grandma's boy. I'm a mama's boy and a grandma's boy, and my grandmother was an incredibly powerful woman. You know, she was a not, and I don't mean that politically or anything like that. She was a house cleaner, and then she also worked for the, you know, cleaners, and mm-hmm. criticized me every time I ironed my clothes because it wasn't as good as hers. but she was an amazing woman, and she used to wear opium perfume, you know, when she was going out and getting fancy. Like, this is, you know, this is church. We're going to go out and get fancy because, my family, that side of my family attended church, you know, when she was getting ready to. Like, I knew it was time to go do something fancy. She would get her little gum out, and she would get her opium perfume, and she would throw on her little fake jewelry and stuff, and you know, get fly.
Right.
And this right here, you know, I always say, just like my mom, you know, and a lot of children born, men of color, and I can't say other men because I don't know. I haven't been within those communities enough, but definitely men of color, Native men, who are raised by single moms, there's this sort of weird, almost romantic relationship that happens with our moms and grandma, because we end up being the men in the household.
Mm-hmm.
And so we become the dads, we become the fathers, you know, even though we're little kids. And I was certainly like that with both my mom and my grandma. We had that very, very flirtatious relationship, and not in a weird way, but in a loving way and in a sweet way. This story, Opium, is about that sort of semi-flirtatious relationship with my grandma. I'll read that to you now. I was standing in the checkout line of the grocery store when her scent glided by. I smelled her before I saw her, dripping with perfume, smiled, closed my eyes. The familiar fragrance of opium in the room. Knew it ever since I was a baby, probably knew it in the womb. She always smelled of opium and breath mint and whichever flower was in bloom. Smelled like wedding flowers every day. What a lucky groom. Yeah, grandma always smelled good. Even while cooking amazing food that I'd soon consume, opened my eyes, turned around from the checkout line, see who this was making my nostrils swoon, a little old white lady. Probably 75, standing in the produce aisle, squeezing watermelons and honeydews, probably preparing a fruit salad. She was beautiful. I went to say hi, tell her that she reminds me of someone, and thank you for walking by. You made my day. She gave me a wink. I blushed and smiled larger. My grandma used to wink at me the same way. She flirted with my soul, gave my conscience butterflies. Took me back to when I was a child sitting in church. Imagine myself going back in time on some Marty McFly stuff, ready to make her all mine, or at least make grandpa work a little harder. Who cares if I mess up the timeline, space-time continuum destroyed, as long as she cooks for me every night. That's just fine. Protect her from all the ugliness in her early life. Provide for her as God designed, cocktail dresses and pearls. Opium in a baby blue Thunderbird, laced like Audrey Hepburn, Marilyn Monroe. I heard, it was nice talking to you, sweetheart, but I have to go. Opened my eyes and I was back in the produce aisle, smelling opium.
That's beautiful. I just love, that really struck me the moment I read it. It was just this deep familial love, and you wrote it in a romantic way, which was what kind of, it's very rare to see.
Thank you. Yeah, a lot of my stories are, you know, I suppose, Indian stories. I'm Native, right? So you're naturally supposed to, I guess, you know, people when they talk about my writing, you know, they say, oh, you know, you write like Sherman Alexie, or, you know. And God bless that comparison. Sherman Alexie's amazing.
You know, he's one of my favorites, and we interview him all the time. And Sherman's a great human being and a great writer.
Yeah, he is. He's powerful. But, you know, my writing is more influenced by James Thurber and by Kurt Vonnegut. And just because I happen to be Native doesn't necessarily mean that I write Native stories. And this is an example. This could be anybody's friend.
Right.
It should be. You know, that's a powerful, powerful feeling to have that close attachment with your grandparents. You know, it doesn't require you to be a certain color to do so. I love grandparents. I just had recently, I told you I just got back from Colorado. I had a wonderful trip with my, I met this beautiful couple, this beautiful white couple. She was Norwegian. He was Finnish, and he made it a point. I mean, to me, they were just white. But he made it a point to tell me he was Finnish. They were a beautiful couple. Her name was Mary Carol, and his name was Dick. And, you know, in this generation, nobody names their kids Dick anymore. But his name was Dick, and, you know, they were wonderful. They were 79 years old. They just got them coming back from a vacation, I guess, in Arizona. And I met up with them in Phoenix. You know, we flew back together, and we were in the same aisle. And they were just beautiful. And she reminded me of my grandma. that's not a color thing. That's not a race thing. That's just a familial spirit thing, you know, that she had this wonderful maternal spirit, and she loved, you know, she loved. And I could tell by the way she talked about her kids, she loved them a lot of the same ways that my grandma did. It's not a color thing. It's not a race thing. And the stories hopefully feel universal like that.
That was Jossie Ross, who's a member of the Blackfoot tribe and author of How to Say I Love You in Indian. There's more of my conversation with Jossie coming right up after this break. The Lion Sleeps Tonight by Solomon Linda and the Evening Birds, recorded in 1939. And on this day in 2006, three of Solomon Linda's children won a six-year court battle that gave them a 25% of all past and future royalties for that song. Solomon Linda wrote that song when he was a cleanup man at a Johannesburg record company. He received virtually nothing for that song and died in 1962 with $25 in his bank account. The song was later recorded by artists like Pete Seeger, the Kingston Trio, the Tokens, Carl Denver, R.E.M., and it was featured in the Disney film The Lion King. It's estimated that the song earned nearly $15 million for its use in The Lion King alone. Justice was done on this day. Steiner Show is brought to you by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to Common Core, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's one word, MarylandEducators.org. Or you can go to SteinerShow.org and click on the Maryland State Education Association's banner.
Another child grows up to be somebody you just love to burn.
Welcome back, and that, of course, was Family Affair by Sly and the Family Stone. Rosemary Stone of Sly and the Family Stone was born on this day in 1945. Happy birthday, Rosemary. This hour, we're talking with Jossie Ross, who's a member of the Blackfeet Nation. His new book is called How to Say I Love You in Indian. One of the things I noticed in this book, because of the place that I come from and people I've known 40 years back and still know some of them, is you made this little jab in the beginning of the book about some Native men who want to have a dozen kids across the country.
Yeah.
I saw that in there, and I immediately flashed on some guys who are like my age who I know who were part of AIM and other groups, and that's exactly what a lot of people, that's what happened.
Right.
Could you talk about that a minute, why you put that in there?
Well, I mean, keep in mind, Mark, I try not to critique unless I see, you know, I don't want to just point fingers. I think that's unconstructive.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And there's a part of me that, you know, that admires those guys, that wants to be those guys, that wants to live a life of just, you know, recklessness and no real responsibility. But, and I say that, I mean that 100% honestly, matter of factly, like, I considered that. But fatherhood, I saw the consequences of that specifically in my life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that I saw what happened being raised without a father. And so, you know, I was like, no, I can't do that. I can't do that. And so I've always taken fatherhood extremely seriously. And so when I say that, it's definitely critique, and it's definitely, there's a level of judgment to that. But it's a level of judgment that says, I'm kind of complicit in that as well. I didn't do that physically, but I've thought about it. I understand where they're coming from, and I just don't want to be that. I think that we can do better. And sometimes we have to, you know, even against our own wishes. You know, I don't always want to be on point as a father or as a community leader or a community member. You know, like, I coach little kids basketball. And, you know, sometimes I would rather just stay at home in my boxers and watch Maury Povich. But I understand that I have to put myself aside. It's bigger than me sometimes. And I don't think that that's what people did at that time. And I know that there's still people who do not do that. And I think that's unfortunate, because that's part of being a member of the community, is to put the community first. And that's not putting the community first, because we see the effects of that every day. We're living in a generation of people who you know, one of the first generations where that is rampant. That behavior is rampant and excused, and it's not a good thing. You know, it's not a good thing. So, that's where it comes from. It is a level of judgment, but I think it's justified judgment because I think it's something that will make our communities better.
So one of the things, Jossie, that I'm really taken with, and many people are, I think, is the cover. And you wrote this beautiful piece inside about this woman, Dawn Mist.
Yeah.
Talk a bit about, why you chose that picture. I mean, folks who haven't seen the book, it's a picture of a Native man on horseback and a woman looking up at him like they're talking, and an Indian Cupid.
Yeah.
Shooting an arrow.
The Cupid was the product of my good friend, Stephen Paul Judd, who's an extraordinary artist, a lot of different formats. He makes film. He's just a weirdo, but he makes incredible stuff. And, you know, weirdos make the best artists, right? And he saw this, we saw this picture because we were trying to find something to me that was iconic. And I'm biased. I mean, I'm Blackfeet. And so I wouldn't mind, you know, there's a lot of times where I come from was Blackfeet Reservation gets a bad rap. Paul Harvey once infamously said that if you want to get away with murder, go to the Blackfeet Reservation. So that's the opposite of the message that I'm trying to send with this book. You know, it's supposed to be loving. It's about love. To offset that, I think we have plenty. I told the story at the beginning of the book about my grandpa Percy going from place to place trying to find cures for his cancer-stricken wife, my grandmother, you know, to cure her. And to me, that's a beautiful story of love. And this image, this photograph at the cover on the cover, I thought was also one of those. It showed a picture of very, very, in my estimation, respectful and, you know, traditional notions of Blackfeet love and Native love more generally. And Dawn Mist, she was this lady who was just renowned for her beauty. You know, I think of her as sort of like Cleopatra, where people would come just to see her.
Yeah, I looked her up. She's gorgeous.
Yeah.
She's a beautiful woman. Yeah.
And it's cool because I'm actually her grandchildren. I mentioned them in the book, Frederica, Tony, Glenda, Kathy Gillum. Those folks are, you know, that they're her family, and they're friends of mine, good friends of mine now. And so, you know, I thought it was just really cool to have this very, very regal and beautiful Native and Blackfeet woman, and to show this image where, you know, this in this beautiful field, you know, and sort of like, you know, I'm not sure if, you know, anybody's relationship to Montana, but it's called Big Sky Country for a reason. It's a huge place.
Right.
But throughout all this square footage and acreage and mileage, these two, you know, beautiful young Blackfeet people come together, and they're there, and they're talking, and they're enjoying the space. And I think that's just a beautiful image.
It was, and now you've made me really intrigued to find out more about this woman. So,
yeah, she was, you know, it was cool because she actually was one of the people who later on, I'm not sure if I mentioned it in the book, but she got involved. It gave her a platform to focus on, like, women's suffrage and stuff like that. It was in 1919 when women, you know, quote-unquote universal suffrage passed.
Right.
She was on the front edges of that. She moved to Spokane, became, you know, she moved to Spokane and got some opportunities to be sort of a spokesperson for different causes. You know, I think of her sort of as a, you know, today there's a lot of people who are just kind of famous for being famous. What's good about that is if those people have, you know, good intentions. I think it was Alexander the Great that said, "I'm not afraid of a nation of wolves led by a sheep. I'm scared of a nation of sheep led by a wolf." And, you know, if we have wolves
right
on the other side of this equation, when people get famous and can advocate for some positive, proactive things, that could be good. You know, if Kim Kardashian was doing something where she was, you know, she was using her celebrity for something that was, you know, amazing. Let's get rid of the Keystone XL pipeline. Then, yeah, that's cool. That's a positive use of something, you know. But unfortunately, that's not what happens. You know, folks use fame just to get more fame and use to get, you know, a little bit of personal gain. Whereas Dawn Mist, on the other hand, used it to try to do something good for all people, including Native people.
And I'm glad you told that story because I think it's an important one, and she's a very interesting character, so people should know more about this woman. But one of the things I thought about in this entire book, because as we talked about earlier, it's not a book about romantic love necessarily. There's some romance in it, but not a book about romantic love. It's a book about the power of a culture, the power of survival, the power of bringing men back into the fold, and the power that men do have, and the power of Indian women.
Yeah, definitely.
And so I'm wondering, when you look at, you know, as a student of your own history and of this country's history,
right,
and you see what love may have meant in the 19th, 18th, 17th, 16th century among your people, among the Blackfoot,
right,
what's happened to it because of the wars and then reservations, and what that kind of colonial oppression has meant, and where you see it going now, because you mentioned men who were huge in your life, that they, in the traditional sense, really took care of people and wanted to do that.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, that in that arc, where do you think this love is taking you, Blackfeet people, Indian people in general? And to me, when you do that, it's also taking America there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're kind of like the mining canaries, you know. I mean, a lot of this stuff, you know, because a lot of our communities are these small homogenous communities, that there's a lot of experimentation there. And ultimately, a lot of the stuff that happens within our communities ends up being, yeah, that's the way the rest of the world is going, you know. And, I mean, excuse me, the rest of the United States is going. And, you know, we're like these human ant farms. Historically, right, we definitely had, you know, these notions of just love is survival in the most literal sense of the word. No hyperbole, no exaggeration. Love is survival. Everything that we did, and this is true of any culture when you go from a hunter-gatherer culture, everything that you do is dedicated towards survival of the community. One of the things up here in the Northwest Coast on the reservations where I'm from, or where I'm also from, my family, the Suquamish Reservation, for example, people are, you know, anthropologists, they attribute the amazing tapestries that the coastal natives made historically as being representative of having some free time, having an element of free time, because on the waters, you know, out on the beach, the food was so plentiful. You can get food easily. You don't have to expend every single calorie and every single minute trying to survive. That's not true at most places in the world. And I'm not just saying the United States, I'm saying the world. When we come from hunter-gatherer cultures, it was hard to get food. It was hard to, on a daily basis, survive, make enough food to, you know, there wasn't the social programs and whatnot. Love literally meant survive. We're going to get enough food, and I'm going to show you that I love you, son or wife or husband, by feeding. And I can't afford really to be overly affectionate. I can't afford to be overly, you know, spend a lot of free time with you, because what's free time, right? As you know, we're also, you know, part of the United States. We're part of this larger genus of people called Americans, whether we like it or not. I'm not too fond of that, but it's true. And what affects the United States at large, it also affects us. And so as things got more convenient, and one of the points I make in one of the poems, I mean, I speak about convenience a lot, because, you know, we've become a culture of convenience, and so has love. And so when you have, not all the time is dedicated toward, you know, making sure that there's enough food on the table, or making sure there's enough wood to stay warm, or making sure that there's, you know, enough shelter. When those things stop being the primary source of concern, you would think, theoretically, that there's more time then to show affection. You know, there's more time to express love in other ways. Okay, maybe it's verbal. Maybe it's through Hallmark, Hallmark cards and stuff like that. But the truth is that this culture has begun, and we see this with such phenomena as, you know, Black Friday and the commercialism of Christmas and holiday seasons, and really any holiday, is that now, you know, Native people more and more, unfortunately, as a product of, you know, being part of America, it just like the rest of America, shows love by virtue of material goods.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to spend my time, I'm going to spend my dollars.